This message is titled, Who Touched Me? But we can consider this message's subtitle to be Fear, Part 2. In today's reading, you get a two-for-one deal. There are actually two stories wrapped up into one account. In Mark's mind, they're all part of the same story, and thank you, Eric, for reading. There's a little bit going on, so at the moment, we'll take a look at them separately, but remember that these stories actually belong together. What Mark has done is to place one story inside the other. In other words, he's made what some call a Markan sandwich, something that you can just enjoy as you bite down. And he does it again later in Mark chapter 11, and you can go there at your own leisure. Basically, the stories season each other, and they add flavor and zest to one another. In other words, the stories inform each other. The outer story is about Jairus, one of the local synagogue leaders, and mostly about his 12-year-old daughter. The inner story is about a much older woman who, for the same 12 years, has suffered internal bleeding. Now, both stories, if we read closely, are about fear and faith and the power of Jesus to take people from one to the other. Both stories are worth taking a look at, so if you haven't yet opened your Bibles to the passage of Mark chapter 5, I invite you to do so now at this time. If you wouldn't mind turning to verse 22 in today's passage, let's begin by looking at Jairus. Now again, he's the synagogue leader, or the president, if you will. But in a small town, his title isn't that great. It's not that grand a title. Most synagogue leaders weren't happy with what was happening every time Jesus entered their towns. As Jesus traveled and taught from Nazareth all the way to Capernaum, he was not the easiest person to host in the local village congregation. From challenging the status quo to outrageous teachings and miraculous healings, to open questioning of the local authorities, Jesus was making the legal experts not too happy. He's rocking the boat. What would happen if the fierce and at times vicious Romans who had the authority took notice? What would happen if they took notice? No one wanted any trouble. So obviously Jairus wasn't really wanting to do anything with Jesus. He wanted nothing to do with him, in fact. He probably wanted to keep a safe distance and let others interact with this Jesus. And he was probably thinking it's better just to be someone who stayed on that safe middle ground. So let's just watch and see what happens if you look with me into the Word. Of course, he's feeling that way until disaster strikes his own household, right? And his daughter, who is 12, you'll see that in verse 42, she's almost old enough in that culture to get married. She gets so sick that she's about to die. And so Jairus, along with his entire household, is so distraught that Jairus himself forgets about his pride, he forgets about his fear, and when he hears about Jesus, the troublemaker, the strange teacher has just come back from across the lake, and he thinks, I am desperate. I'm going to go and see this Jesus. Maybe he can help me. Why worry about religious controversy or political danger when your precious child is dying? So Jairus rushes off to see Jesus, and he actually throws himself down at Jesus' feet. Verse 22. And can you imagine what some of the other leaders are thinking? Ah, now what are they going to think about this guy the next Sabbath? He makes his request. No, actually, he pleads his request with Jesus to come and heal his child. And so, in verse 24, Jesus goes with him, and a very eager crowd tags along. And it's at this point in the story that Mark transitions to the story of the older woman in verse 25. This story not only keeps us in suspense as of what's going to happen with Jairus' daughter, but it provides even more depth and meaning to the first story. So Jesus is on his way to Jairus' home when we expect to find possibly a dead girl by this time. Naturally, most people hearing the story at the time would be immediately thinking of sorrow, loss, but also the threat of impurity, because a dead body is unclean. Coming into contact with a corpse is one of the chief sources of impurity in Jewish law. You might recall that from our studies in Leviticus. But here now is a woman who has chronic internal bleeding, and she interrupts the whole scene. Keep in mind, one of the other main causes of impurity was bodily discharges, and those people who had them, especially women. Jairus is asked if Jesus could save his daughter, and the woman says to herself in verse 27 and 28, "Well, if only I can just even touch Jesus' clothes, I'll be healed." Clearly, there's supposed to be some jostling in between these two people and their worlds. We're not sure how she knew she was healed, but she obviously felt pretty good, and she knew something had happened in verse 29. The woman's health had kept her ritually impure and unclean, and you can find that in Leviticus chapter 15. This would have had a drastic impact on her involvement in her family and in her social life, and even in her religious life. She would have been eking out a very disconnected and solitary and most likely a lonely existence. And this would explain her fear of requesting even further help. All others who had helped her in the past only made things worse. Just take a look at verse 26. One wonders if that meant that the doctors made things worse physically. For sure, it was financially worse. She spent everything she had. But we wonder also if all these treatments just re-injured her emotionally, socially, and even spiritually. She felt victimized by the systems that were supposed to help. And so could one fault her being so afraid to go out and talk to Jesus face to face? Normally, she'd have to yell out loud to those around her, "Unclean! I'm unclean!" Just like the lepers. "Don't touch me, I'll make you unclean." So instead, she reaches out in the middle of the crowd, and take a look at verse 30. It's pretty funny, actually. Jesus responds with, "Okay, who touched my clothes?" Can you imagine that? They're a big, giant scrum. It's kind of a funny picture here. It'd be almost like the BC Lions in an end zone pileup, and our quarterback, Kevin Glenn, just quipping from underneath many bodies, "Excuse me, does anyone know who touched me?" Underneath all that. Can you imagine that? Well, the disciples bark back some indignant replies in verse 31. "Jesus, we're being pressed on all sides, and you want us to tell you who touched you? We don't even know who touched us." Well, all the attention then immediately goes to Jesus, who's now looking around at who touched him. And in verse 32, he's checking the whole scene out. And all of us are now looking, what's going to happen next? In verse 34, Jesus says to the woman, "Your faith has saved you." And he tells Jairus, "Don't be afraid, only believe," in verse 36. Can you see the sparks that these two stories are kind of hitting each other? Jesus restores personhood and wholeness, shalom, in other words, peace, to the woman. He says, "Daughter," possibly something that she hasn't heard in quite some time. When was the last time that she heard this from her own dad? Never mind the rabbi at the local synagogue. The impurity has prevented her from socializing with her family. Never mind the general public. Jesus has ultimately restored her physically and socially. Jesus also does this in plain sight of all who are crowding in and around the woman. Imagine their horror as they realize they had just touched her because she's been pressing in around everybody. And as they were pressing in on Jesus, just the problem is what she's done needs to be exposed to the crowd. Not because it was wrong, but actually because it was right. The crowd has not become unclean by her touch. And instead, she has become clean by touching Jesus. And the crowd needs to know that. We need to know that. We need to be reminded that Jesus indeed heals. So here's Jesus declaring her healed and clean, and her humiliation has been public knowledge for so long, therefore her healing must be public knowledge as well. In his charge for her to be free from suffering, he also speaks to those around the woman, saying, you know what, she belongs in community again. Don't ignore your neighbor, your sister, your wife, your daughter. This healing isn't merely physical. It has social and spiritual dimensions as well. Jesus is the gentle healer. Now, one of the miracles here is that Jesus knows power has gone out from him in verse 30. Mark clearly shows that there is an element of intimacy in the healing contact between Jesus and whomever he comes into contact with. Second, the Bible account begs us to ask the question, was it Jesus' power that rescued the woman, or was it her faith? Clearly, it was Jesus' power, but he says, "Your faith has rescued you." Now, although faith, though itself, is powerless, it is the channel through which Jesus' power can work. Just go to chapter 6 of Mark and verse 5. Jesus is no sorcerer, he is no magician, and he does not do tricks that are intended to amaze an uninvolved audience. Jesus is actually God's Son, the one through who the living God is remaking Israel and humanity and indeed the world. And faith is that sign, that first sign of that remaking, that renewal, that new life. So then the question is, where are we in this interesting story? So the question we need to ask ourselves is, are we trapped in fear like this woman or like Jairus? Are we afraid of what others will think of us? Are we afraid for our name and for our reputation? Are we the ones who fear loss of social standing or social status? Maybe, like me, you're afraid of giving up control. Because if I give up control, what will God have me do next? That are my hands. And Jesus says to those of us like Jairus, don't be afraid, only believe. Like the bleeding woman, are we trapped in our past? Are we afraid of what God might think of us? Are we afraid that we might be unworthy or too dirty or unclean or not good enough to come before the throne? And Jesus says to those of us like the bleeding woman, my child, your faith has rescued you. Go in peace. Be healed from your suffering. One of the challenges that Jesus leaves us here with is that shalom or peace or wholeness, it involves the whole community of faith. How are we as a faith community, as neighbors, as husbands and wives, as parents, as children, how are we helping to contribute to each other's wholeness? That's a question we need to ask ourselves. I think Mark hopes that all who connect with Jesus can experience this very same intimate contact and connection with Jesus, the gentle healer. When life crowds in with all of its pressures, maybe past is coming up, there's still room for us to creep up behind Jesus, if that's all we feel that we can do, and reach out to touch him. Jesus is gracious and compassionate. He's slow to anger and rich in love. He'll meet us there in our fear. It's that odd mixture of fear and faith that characterize our long walk in following Jesus. Now, I don't have quick solutions or three detailed suggestions for us on how to wrestle with our own personal fears. I know that God will give each of us tools and help each of us to go through each of our own journeys. We need each other. And as we continue to reach out to God for healing, let us continue to pray for peace. Not only that God will suddenly reach down and with his touch immediately put things in order, but that he will help us to choose to follow him. That is much more difficult, as difficult as that might be. So brothers and sisters, let us work toward being a caring and compassionate community, ready to be God's hands and feet as he calls us, for those who hurt and for those who fear. And let us continue to ask God to transform our hearts by the renewing of our minds. So as the worship team comes up with our closing song, let me close with a poem from one of Al's prayer letters. It's written by the late Bud Osborne, a downtown Eastside poet and activist. The poem is set in World War II at the death camp known as Auschwitz. The poem not only talks about bravery, but community and the need for us to have community, to be human. This poem is called The Truth of Community by Bud Osborne. Just imagine with me as we're in the camp in Poland. All day long, the horrible sun set them on fire, and machine guns and attack dogs and barbed wire fences wired with electricity, where teenage boys threw themselves to escape Auschwitz. A prisoner fled the camp, or so the Nazis said, and lined the 600 men of Barrack 14 into rows. The men were forbidden to speak, sit down, or take one step out of line under penalty of immediate execution. All day long, until Assistant Camp Commandant Fritsch arrived and announced that since the escaped prisoner had not been found, 10 of the men standing there would die. And Fritsch began to walk the rows, examining the prisoners, selecting which of them would be stripped naked, locked in a cellar half buried in the earth, and kept there until they starved to death. One of the condemned men, a young Polish soldier, Francis Gajowniczek, fell to his knees and cried out that he had a young wife and small children and wanted to live. Fritsch ordered the man to the starvation cell, but then something extraordinary occurred, something unheard of in Auschwitz. A man stepped forward out of the rows and began to speak. Fritsch commanded the man to get back into line. "Have you gone mad?" Fritsch shouted at him. But the prisoner calmly replied that he wished to take Francis Gajowniczek's place. The man explained that since he himself was old and ill, the Nazis could get more work from a younger man. And Assistant Camp Commandant Fritsch, according to witnesses, fell silent and appeared stunned. The August sun burned the air, and Auschwitz fell silent. Fritsch pondered, then astonishingly rescinded his own order and granted the prisoner's request. So Maximilian Kolbe joined the other 9 men, stripped of their clothes, and interred in their tomb. Kolbe's own hard-won community of Franciscans, who had housed refugees, fed the poor, repaired the machinery of peasant farmers, and dispensed medicine to any who were in need, had been destroyed. His brothers murdered or sent to exile, and Kolbe incarcerated in Auschwitz. First, the brain dehydrates and hallucinates, but Kolbe remained lucid and comforted the others. They sang canticles of love in a death cell in Auschwitz. And on the 14th day, when Nazis entered the cell to remove the bodies, Maximilian Kolbe, still alive, had to be killed with an injection of phenic acid. Kolbe, who lived community while naked and starving to death. Kolbe, who sang community into a situation without hope. Kolbe, who demonstrated that community cannot be destroyed, though buildings are demolished, though people are scattered and lives shattered. Kolbe, who taught that community cannot be extinguished, as long as a single human being steps forward, out of line, and speaks out for the sake of another's life. Kolbe. Brothers and sisters, let's step out of line. Let's speak out for the sake of another's life. As Jesus said, don't be afraid, only believe. Thanks be to God. Amen.